Welcome. I've been asked to talk about the characteristics of remnant soils along urbanization gradients. I consider remnant soils the other urban soil. And I'll talk more about, you'll see why I refer to them that way as I go along. Before I get too far, quiz. Where do you think these photos were taken? You only get a few seconds because I don't want to cut into my time too much. New York City. This is New York City Parks. And this is just to give you an example of how we do have remnants of landscapes that native landscapes that continue in urban landscapes. Before I get too far, I just want to mention that I'm going to be talking about showing a lot of data, and obviously I didn't collect it myself. Have had lots of help, not only in collecting data, but intellectually about this. And also, I'd like to also mention that the Phoenix LTR has done a lot of great soil work as well. So what I'm going to talk to you about is give you a general introduction on what I consider the importance of these remnant soils in urban landscapes from the perspective of carbon and nitrogen dynamics. But also, then I'm going to talk about the approach and how we've been studying these urban effects on these remnants. And I'm going to be doing that with some case studies in Baltimore and the Baltimore LTR, but also work that we did in New York City. So lots of old data, but some more recent data. And I like to start talking about remnants by looking at what I consider the process of land use change and how it has impacts on soils. And I think of two different ways in which this occurs. One is more of a direct effect, and another is more of an indirect effect on soils. And we can think of, we're usually, most of the talks you're going to hear this morning talk about these direct effects, these physical disturbances of soils. And they start with when the early European settlers first got to North America, started with parcelization. They started to break up the landscape into ownership parcels. Native Americans didn't really have that concept of ownership. And through parcelization, we had fragmentation. And so you can think of as the population density increases, these parcels get smaller and smaller. So ultimately, you have this big change in disturbance regimes, and also and which is related to the management that occurs. But what we often forget is that there's an indirect effect while this is all happening, and that is there's an environmental change that occurs. And so we can think of altered climate, we can think of pollution, we can think of introductions of exotic species. This ultimately changes the environment. So when you overlap all of this, and then on top of that, you have this built environment. Humans have put these built structures and all of that on top of the native landscape, and gets what I call the urban mosaic. So think of an urban soil mosaic, which I like to think of as this grand natural experiment just waiting for us to utilize and to do research on. And so here's a fragment of a landscape in Baltimore, Maryland, and you can think of these highly managed sites like golf courses and athletic fields. You can think of these fallow sites, and you were just hearing a lot about some fallow sites in Detroit, where land that was once disturbed is now left to nature, basically. But we also have these remnants, these natural areas, often find in just about every city that I've been in North America, you'll often find these. And, of course, we have these small parcels with landowners that are making decisions about managing their landscape that's having an impact on those soils. So you can think of this mosaic. And in Baltimore, this is work done by Dave Nowak of the U.S. Forest Service. He's actually gone out and sampled all the vegetation. And if we look at where the trees are in this landscape, for instance, these are the number of trees and the density per hectare. And you can see the forest and urban open, which is area that's fallow, basically, roughly half the trees in that landscape are occurring in those parcels. And if you think about all the other land use types there, not all of those trees have been planted for sure. There's some naturalized vegetation. More than half of the trees in that landscape were not planted. They got there by themselves. Now, this is not going to be true in other areas of the country, obviously, where trees don't naturally grow. But in the northeastern and mid-Atlantic states, southeast, absolutely. So we can look at the carbon density of the above and below ground carbon in these landscapes. And this is a very coarse land use land type, land use land cover designations of forest, residential, so on and so forth. The dark bar there, this is the carbon density in the soils. And this includes soils underneath the impervious surfaces. And you can see that the carbon density for these forest fragments can be quite high. Which is really interesting, though, is that these residential areas, for soils anyway, you can also have lots of carbon in the soil, especially the older soils that have been managed for a long period of time, irrigated, like Howard was potentially showing. You can get a buildup of carbon. In the above ground, in the residential, not so. So that's what a northern forest would expect in our part of the world. So like I said before, you can take this urban soil mosaic and consider it. You can look at it and just throw your arms up and say, there's too much heterogeneity. How do we deal with this? Or we can utilize it as a natural experiment. And so we do this in two ways. One is an environmental gradient. We can take these remnant patches that are in the urban context, and we can compare them to remnant patches in a rural context and in between, and however you can do that. Now, we can look at this as a direct gradient analysis, you know, a linear line on a map, or you can do this in an indirect gradient analysis, which I don't have enough time to describe, but this is how ecologists do, plant ecologists, for example, do this quite often. So if we try to maintain all the soil-forming factors and equalize them as much as possible, and the only thing that varies is your context, urban versus rural versus suburban, I call that an anthroposequence. Now, what you were seeing before, earlier talk, you can also look at those patches and compare them on the landscape. And I thought the previous speaker did a nice job about site history, for example. You can look, so as chronosequences. We can look at management and compare different management types and so on and so forth. We can aggregate patches up into, say, a watershed scale, a small watershed, and compare watersheds, totally forested watershed with a suburbanized watershed with an urbanized watershed. And we've done this in Baltimore. So, but I'm going to be focusing on the anthroposequence up here. Now, just to give you a comparison of how we can start looking at this landscape, and again, most of the talks you're going to hear about this morning are looking at those really highly disturbed, drastically disturbed situations. But we also know that we have these remnants out there, and we also know we have these fallow systems that in some cases have had time to have soil formation occur. So this is a very coarse scale look at Baltimore City landscape for land use and cover. Dave Nowak set up 200 plots to do his plant analysis. We collected soil samples. And just to show you, this is a canonical discriminant analysis, and basically we a priori designated classes for these soils. And it's a MANOVA analysis that also does something like very similar to a principal component analysis. And we find that the forest soils all show up over here. And you can see in the array here on the first canonical discriminant analysis, these residential sites are discriminated from these forested sites by phosphorus, potassium, and bulk density. In all cases, it's higher in that residential landscape versus the forest. That kind of makes sense. NPK, that's what people put on their lawns when they fertilize. Higher bulk densities, more impacts, and things like that. Which is kind of surprising, though, is that organic matter didn't pop out, right? And the other thing was heavy metals didn't pop out. More on that later. And that's other turf, which had a pH difference with the residential turf. I don't have enough time to explain that one. But it was an interesting findings. So now if we do this urban-rural gradient analysis, the rural context with the urban context, remember, these are natural remnant soils. And we argue that in some cases we can look at these urban-rural gradients as an analog of global change. We can think of things like CO2 concentrations, heat stress, growing season length, ozone, other pollutants, and we can interface that with nitrogen deposition, invasive species, and so on. And I refer you to a great paper by Margaret Carrero and Chris Tripler, 2005, in Ecosystems, that talks more about this. So we have developed a conceptual framework to start looking at these environmental impacts on these forest remnants along these gradients in the following way. And basically, you could think of, we've coupled the carbon and nitrogen cycle here because we're very interested in carbon and nitrogen dynamics. And we can look at environmental changes Typically, on global and regional scales, soil moisture, soil temperature are the big controlling factors of net primary productivity, but also decay in the soil. So we can think of these two processes that are occurring that's coupled through the leaf litter that comes back into the system and the release of nitrogen in that system. So we're going to take a look at, we've taken a look at most of these arrows, not in great detail, but I'm going to try to go through these and come back to this framework in a little bit. But the big point here is that we have factors that impact the plants, but we also have factors that impact the organisms in the soil and affect decay rate, and that they're coupled through the leaf litter quality and also the release of nitrogen. So we have lots of non-native species introductions, and Howard did a nice job of introducing us to earthworms, and Kathy Slavitz will probably talk much more about this as well. But we know that very early on with the training that was going on in Europe, there were these non-native species of European species of worms that were introduced more recently, it seems to be Asian. We've got plants coming in. Plants can also have an impact, so on and so forth. So we actually did these measurements in New York City gradient. Now, New York City was glaciated, so you wouldn't expect to see any worms in these soils, really. But we were finding all kinds of earthworms in the urban sites, and they were not only European origin, but we were discovering Asian species. And I guess Kathy will talk more about that as well. So, and this is also a graph from Kathy, and this is data from Baltimore forest patches, and the point here is that Baltimore was not glaciated, so you would expect to see native species, which we do, but still there's a very high proportion of non-natives. So there's might be some displacement going on here that's hard thing to show, but it's possible. Isopods, entirely all the species have been introduced. Now, if we look at atmospheric changes, CO2 concentrations, we have an eddy flux tower in Baltimore. Luziska has also measured carbon dioxide. They can spike at greater than 500 parts per million. So that's a spike. It's very variable during the day. But nonetheless, there are higher CO2 concentrations in urban. We all know about the heat island effect on the right. We've actually measured this in the soil, a recent paper in Soil Science Society of America. Journal, and not only do we get differences between lawns and forests, but we also get differences between urban forest patches and rural forest patches, and this actually translates to extended growing seasons as well. this is through-fall nitrogen data for New York City gradient. This is Gary Lovett. This is total nitrogen, inorganic nitrogen coming into these forests, twice the amount of nitrogen coming into these red oak forests and urban landscape versus the rural landscape. That's potentially a huge impact. And this was all through-fall data, but we estimated the deposition rate to be about 25 kilograms per hectare per year, which is a lot of nitrogen. One thing I wanted to also mention, that calcium also has a very similar relationship here. I don't have time to show you all that data. So this is a very old graph. You can tell it was done in the 90s when didn't have all the graphic programs we have now. I had to do some of it by hand. But so we take all the data that we collected on the soils and along this urban-rural gradient, and we considered it an anthropo-sequence because all the soil-forming factors are relatively similar. And we found that the urban plots all clumped on the right based on the first principle component. And basically it was heavy metal concentrations were elevated, soil organic matter. This is mineral soil organic matter, electrical conductivity, and calcium. And I'll talk more about the organic matter in a minute. The heavy metal concentrations were found even though these forests were well beyond what we call the splash zone of the major highway system. So we can take these data and start relating them to aspects that we can measure in the landscape that might be a potential functional relationship. So, for example, lead might be coming from leaded gasoline, or at least the history of leaded gasoline. We don't have lead in gasoline now. And so what we did was we did a 1 square kilometer patch around each one of the forests, so the matrix, and we were able to get traffic volume data. And if we look at the traffic volume and correlate it with the lead concentrations, we get a 0.95. You know, when do you ever get that in ecology? But this is, again, is beyond that 30-meter splash zone. Most of the work that's been done from roadside work, after you get beyond 30 meters, they consider it background. So this is a regional kind of deposition response going on here. So if we go back to our conceptual model, and if we look at some of the changes that are occurring in that landscape from an environmental perspective and their potential for having impact on the plants and on the organisms, we find that we have these invasive earthworms coming into the system. The length of the growing season has been greatly extended, higher temperatures. We have metals. The whole question about moisture is a really tough one, and I'm not going to even get into that right now, but we haven't really been able to really tease that out. And the same is going on here with the plants as well. And there's a potential for ozone impacts. Nitrogen deposition certainly can have an impact on the plants. So now if we look at a functional response, now we're looking at leaf litter mass loss rates along the gradient, and what you see here is the percent mass remaining, nitrogen remaining, and carbon-nitrogen ratios, and nothing, no difference. And I was like kind of freaking out a little bit. This was my dissertation. But I went out and put a common litter type out, and I did get a difference. So what was going on? So then I went out and did a litter transplant experiment and basically took, this is an urban forest patch, a rural forest patch. This is rural litter, and this is rural litter, all red oak in origin. And then we can compare the side effect. And so we had a greater decomposition rate based on looking at the similar litter types across that gradient, which presumably might have been due to the earthworms or temperature differences. But we didn't get a big effect looking at the native litter, which is what I just showed you, so that's consistent. And then if we look at the litter types, so the rural versus the urban, there was a big difference. So there's a litter quality difference going on there. And so we think the earthworms are somehow having an impact here, not only the temperature differences. So we can look at this another way. We're looking at the forest floor mass now, and this is in the same stands. And if we look at the forest floor mass where we didn't find earthworms, so there were some sites in the urban that didn't have worms, we definitely had a buildup of organic material on those forest floors. Now, whether that's due to greater primary productivity or the slower decay rates, I can't tell you. But when you have worms in the system, there's no difference. So the worms are compensating in some way with this poor quality litter that's coming into the system. So that was a kind of a surprising result. And if you're doing urban-rural gradient studies, remember to do field manipulations. Just don't go with the natural experiment if you really want to get at what's going on. So how does this relate to the carbon in the soil? This is Peter Groffman's work. The passive soil, passive carbon pools are much higher in the urban versus the rural, which is what we showed. But when you look at the more decomposable stuff, it reverses. So that is, again, a signal that this is poor quality litter potentially coming into these stands. And so does this translate to a nitrogen response? Well, again, we did transplants. These are with soil cores. And, yeah, we had a site effect with nitrogen mineralization and nitrification. But we also had a soil type effect. So a soil core taken from the urban really mineralized much more rapidly than the rural. And then also, if we compare the native soil types as well, which is interesting is that we couldn't get the rural soils never nitrified at all. So that was interesting. So we had very similar results in Baltimore. Earthworm biomass, nitrogen mineralization rates, and these are the urban plots up here. So they go up with the earthworms. And so we think that part of this is an earthworm legacy effect. The earthworms have fundamentally changed the habitat for the microorganisms in these soils so that you get this very leaky, potentially leaky nitrogen release there. So now we're looking at the permanent plots in Baltimore, almost getting close to the end here. And these are long-term, 8-year measurements. Peter Groffman led this effort. And if we look at CO2, so respiration coming off the soil, this is an urban forest versus a rural forest, higher. We have less methane uptake. So greater CO2, less methane uptake between these comparisons. So fundamentally, there's something going on here with the carbon and nitrogen cycle. And if we look at other studies, this is a comparison of New York City, Baltimore, and Asheville of end mineralization. And this is work in Asheville, which was done by Mitch Pavo-Zuckerman. And we find that he also got an end mineralization response here, but he did not get a leaf decay response. And that's because he didn't do transplants. So he did the native litters like I did and stopped there, just to give you a comparison. So finally, if we look at our environmental effect that we found, this is in Baltimore, not New York, and this is work done with Peter Groffman, Kathy, and so on. And we've also started to look at the management effects. So this is going across forest compared to lawn to agriculture, so big management differences there. The difference in the nitrification potential response is much greater to manage related to management than this environment effect. Although it's real, the environment effect is much less than a management effect. And so if we finalize, get here at the end, we see that we don't know about plant productivity, but potentially it's been increased because of CO2 and nitrogen. We don't know if this leaf litter response yet. We still have to figure this one out. We don't know if it's a nutrient use efficiency response, so whether the nitrogen's ending up in a litter or not, or whether it's a damage response, because ozone will damage leaf litter, and which will create higher lignin concentrations. And then we can go on from there, and we know that we have greater passive carbon pools in the urban versus the rural. We have higher CO2 release coming off, at least from the labile carbon decay. And we're also getting trace gas fluxes higher in the rural. We don't ultimately know what's going on with the plant biomass, however. So in conclusion, to end up, our remnant forests that, at least in the eastern United States, appear to be regionally important in the storage of carbon. The urban effects that we've measured beyond the splash zone, so these kind of along the urban rural gradient, we've been able to measure these effects, and sometimes beyond the city boundary. And urban environmental change effects on carbon and nitrogen processes might be analogous for climate change. We're still going through that process of determining that. And management, seems like management effects are much greater than the environmental effects. And I will end there. Again, we don't know how it's affecting the trees. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of questions. If anyone has anything for Dr. Pia.
Yeah, Jim.
A lot of discussion about exudates, the liquid carbohydrates coming out of the tree.
You mean tree roots? You mean the tree roots exudates?
The tree root exudates.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, that's a good question. So a big part, CSS fine root and litter mass and blah, blah, in chemistry. We haven't really gotten to the roots yet. However, you know, one hypothesis that you might have for this result here, right there, is that you're getting more root exudates of carbon. And so that might be driving that respiration. But also that's also related to climate, because soil respiration is very tightly coupled to temperature and length of growing season and things like that. So it's it could be a combination. But the exudates could be definitely part of it. Yes. Yes. Good question. Anybody else? Yes. Yes.
But this is Baltimore, which is a very old city compared to many newer cities, so
yeah.
You would expect age to be a major factor there.
Yes. So that's a very good question. I can give you a talk on that if you want. But, so most of the data that I've seen, and there's actually a group in California that's starting to pull all the data together to look at this, about 35 to 45 years, it peaks out in lawns. And then it kind of asymptotes with, we would hypothesize with slower accumulation rates after that, but still getting some accumulation.